Hey, y'all. Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Amy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at Nava Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety will tell his or her story.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes, in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. And our speaker tonight is somebody who has really been a good influence and is probably the only reason that I'm sober today. She's a very strong woman, and she has a great program, and she's worked with a lot of women, and I'll give you Debbie, my mother.
Thanks. I'm Debbie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
And it is really nerve-wracking being up here. I mean, I've told my story a few times here at NAB and other places, and it doesn't seem to get easier right before. It takes me a little while to settle into it. I guess tonight I'm a pinch hitter because a lady named Joan was going to be telling her story tonight, and I was getting ready for the 11 o'clock today, and I got a phone call from Tim. And he said that she was really sick and asked me if I could tell my story, so I agreed to. And the last time I told my story here, the guy was here. I was sitting here waiting to listen to his story, and he walked out. Tim calls me into the lobby. He says, "He left. Will you tell your story?" And I'm like, okay. So I guess I'm, like I said, I'm a kind of a pinch hitter storyteller, but anyway, so I guess I'll just get settled into it. Like I said, I've been coming to NABA for, I'm in my 20th year of sobriety. I got sober on March the 17th, 1997. I walked into these rooms. I was 36 years old. It was the year I would have turned 37. And I hear a lot of people come in their mid-30s. I hear that a lot. And my mom says that's when your kids get some sense is in their 30s. And that was certainly true for me. A little sense anyway. I still don't have much. Anyway, I was, I'll tell a little bit about my background. I was born in a little town called Galax, Virginia in 1960. And my mom and my dad were, it's a mill town. It's in the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains, and it's a little mill town. And they're best known, the town is best known for the Old Fiddler's Convention. It's been going on for many, many, many years. And my parents were factory workers, and, you know, I don't remember a whole lot about, you know, my childhood early on, except for I know I had a sister. I was, you know, we're 11 months apart. So, she and I, you know, I can remember having resentments that she had the same birthday as my mom, and you know, that sort of thing. And we ended up moving from Galax, Virginia in 1965 to Duluth, Georgia, because my father got a job in at General Motors. And it was really, you know, it was a real hard living up there. And so that was a really great opportunity for him to move here and to, you know, make some decent money. And but we moved into a trailer park in Duluth, called Pleasant Hill Trailer Park. It's where Gwinnett Place Mall is now, and that's where I was raised from the time I was 5 years old until I was 13. And my parents were very, very hard workers. My mom, you know, to just give a little history, I've, you know, like I said, you know, I come from a long line of alcoholics. I call my mom today because she does ancestry, And I kind of wanted to get an idea of just how far back that she knew that, you know, there was a lot of the alcoholism in our family. And, I mean, she was giving me all this information. And we had been in those mountains since the 1700s. She had traced us back to then. And that her mother's father was an alcoholic. Her mother's uncle was a bootlegger. And my mother's father's grandfather was a moonshiner. And so I asked the difference between a bootlegger and a moonshiner. And evidently a bootlegger sold stolen liquor, and it couldn't have the tax on the bottle. And they would sell it stolen commercial liquor. And then, of course, moonshiners would get that corn and sugar and the seal and make it. So anyway, that was how a lot of my family, you know, made a living. That's how they supplemented their income, how they fed their children. So I'm sure they not only made it and sold it, I'm sure they drank it too. And I know that my mom's father was an alcoholic, and my dad's father was an alcoholic. Now, I like to say alcoholism is the gift that keeps on giving. So although my parents weren't alcoholics, they were certainly raised in an alcoholic home, and a lot of that dysfunction, you know, came over into my family. And that be saying that, my mother was a workaholic, and my dad was a womanizer, and she worked, you know, sometimes two and three jobs. My dad worked nights. He worked second shift at General Motors. And my sister and I were latchkey kids. We, you know, we kind of did whatever we wanted to, anytime we wanted to, and we got in a lot of trouble. And we had a lot of fun getting in trouble. My mom wanted to, the reason she worked so hard is she wanted to try to give me and Becky a life that you know, she didn't have, or that my father, you know, my father nor she had. They lived, you know, they were raised pretty poor. And so by the time I was 13, Mama had worked long enough and hard enough to put a down payment on a house, and then we moved to this subdivision called Cardinal Lake. And my father still lives in the house to this day. And like I said, being kids that, you know, when we left for school, my father would still be in bed because he had worked all night, and my mom had already begun to work. And so Becky and I kind of fended for ourselves a lot. And I guess by the time I was 13, I was experimenting with alcohol. My first drunk was, I think I was 15. I was either 15 or 16. Duluth High School back in those days had a really, really good football team. And I was in the band. I was on the flight corps. And my sister was in the band too. She was either drum majorette or she played the clarinet. I can't remember. And but we went, our football team was so good, we went to state and we played Statesboro. And I don't know if any of you have heard of George Rogers, but he was a Heisman Trophy winner. He went on to play for the South Carolina Gamecocks. And anyway, he was a year ahead of me. And so, and he was he and Napoleon Rogers were like two of the main reasons, you know, our football team was so good and so cohesive. But we ended up losing that game, and one of the drum majorettes are the wild girls in the band, she was able to cop tequila from, I think it was from her older brother, and so she got a half pint of tequila, and I had never drank tequila in my life, but so I took two or three good slugs of that with her, and I do not remember the rest of the night. I mean, this was after the game, of course, and we got back to our hotel room, and I had a blackout the very first time I got drunk. I have no idea. All I know is my sister was trying desperately to get me sobered up enough to be okay for room check. And so she put me in a bathtub while a train of I don't know how many people went to the ice machine and poured ice on me to try to sober me up. And All I know is I did a lot of throwing up, and I was in bed when room check came around, when our band director came around and to make sure everybody was in their rooms, and I was asleep. And she asked Becky, she said, "What's wrong with Debbie?" And oh, she was just really tired. Thank God I didn't get caught. But there was a, you know, the ride home the next day, I was just, oh my God, I was so sick, so sick. And by this time I had, I dated the same guy all through high school, and we were already, and in those days, this was in the 70s, so in those days, you could go to convenience stores, you could go to bars. I mean, it was easy to get alcohol without without an ID. And so we were drinking. I mean, even that, as sick as I was, and as horrible as an experience that was, and, you know, all the stories about Debbie getting drunk and me being afraid that it was going to get around to the, you know, the staff, the school staff, and me getting in trouble, you know, like getting suspended or something like that, which none of those came to pass, but that should have been enough. It just being as sick as I was should have been enough, because it was like 3 or 4 days for me to get over that. But it wasn't long. It was probably the next couple of weekends. We used to go get gallon jugs, like milk jugs, and go to the draft tap in the convenience stores and fill them up. And then we'd go out to Lake Lanier. We partied a lot at Lake Lanier. And there'd just be a bunch of high school kids just, you know, partying. And we would do that every weekend. And but the effect of alcohol, as soon as I put it in my body, it was, because I was a real shy kid. I mean, when I was young, I was so shy and backward. And when I got alcohol in me, you know, I that all went away. You know, I was like 10 foot tall and bulletproof. So that became, you know, just a lifestyle. I had a group of friends. In high school, there were, you know, the social climbers and the jocks, and then there were the, you know, the freaks, or the people who just didn't give a crap what anybody thought of them. And I was friends, you know, just, I had friends in all the echelons. I didn't, you know, kind of, I've always been a GDI, you know, a goddamn independent. And you weren't going to tell me what group I was going to hang with. And, you know, screw you if you didn't like me hanging with the freaks. And, you know, screw the freaks if they didn't like me hanging with the social climbers. You know, that's just how I was growing up. I didn't put myself in any kind of pigeonhole. But, except for the partying. And that's what I really loved to do. I wasn't a very good student. I guess if I could look back on, I mean, if they did stuff that they do now, you know, because they kind of overdo it, I think, with kids nowadays. But if I had been tested, I probably would have been diagnosed with ADHD. I was so hyper, and I could not focus. But I learned, I think, you know, all kids learn how to survive, and they get survival tools. And so I learned how to copy other people's homeworks and cheat on tests and make it through the classes. And I just, you know, I got by. I did graduate from high school in 1978, and it was never, ever a question as far as my mom was concerned. We were going to college. You know, she was going to make sure that we went to college. And I really didn't even have the grades to get into college. My SAT scores were just pitiful. But there were colleges that, as long as you had the money, you could get in, and they'd just give you 099 courses till the cows come home and take your money, you know. So I was an 099 everything, which means you don't get any credit. You know, you have to take the course, but you don't get a college credit until you get out of that course, and then you can get into the college credible courses. So I really was not college material. I wasn't even high school material. I loved it when I first came in here, when I heard that you couldn't be too dumb to get this program. You might be too smart to get this program, but you can't be too dumb to get this program, and that made me so happy. Because I consider myself having street smarts and common sense, but academically, I just never really felt like I had it. So got to college, and I was an 09 everything, and followed one of my best girlfriends was a year older than me, and she went to West Georgia College, so I followed her to West Georgia College, and I mean it was nothing but just party city. And I had started getting had broke up with my high school boyfriend. We were together, like I said, all through high school. We were, you know, voted the couple to make, you know, all those crazy, stupid things they do in the annual, you know, best sports person and most friendly and all that. Well, we were voted the some couple, I don't know, junior couple or senior couple, but we ended up breaking up, and I went on to college, and I was just wild as hell. I mean, I just went just totally wild. And I really didn't care, you know, about my grades or studying or anything. And, you know, it wasn't my dime. It was my mom's dime. It was my dad's dime. I mean, I just didn't care. And but while I was in college, the first year I was in college, the only year I was in college, my parents divorced. And they kind of had, you know, over the years, I think my mom just stayed with him to keep the family together. But as soon as I left, you know, and Becky was a senior at this time, she flew the coop. She left him and divorced him. And then my sister got married. And she was still, you know, a senior in high school, and she married, like, the biggest drug dealer in Duluth. And so anyway, I dropped out of school, and I ended up getting a job in Atlanta. I moved in with my mom, and I got a job in downtown Atlanta at a company. At that time, it was called General Communications. And all this time, mind you, I'm still, you know, drinking, still partying, still wild as hell. In the 70s, it was, they even had a song, Love the One You With, and I tried to keep that song going strong. And but I, like I said, I managed to you know, hold a job down. And but General Communications was the very first cell phone two-way dispatch and beeper company in Atlanta. And so I worked on the service side, and I would do add-ons to accounts, or, you know, and help people with their problems with their beepers or their vibrators, or not that kind of vibrator, but the kind of vibrator that they would call them, and they would know that the company was calling them. And there was, you know, so I could do minor repairs, but if it was more than that, then there was, like, steel rooms in the bag that the technicians would take them in and fix them. And then we also had mobile telephones. And back then, they installed mobile telephones in your car. There was, believe it or not, and how many people in this room have a cell phone?
Everybody.
Back then, 198 people could have a cell phone. That's it. There was 99 capacity on UHF and 99 capacity on VHF. UHF sucked. Everybody wanted VHF, but so there was a waiting list. There was a waiting list as long as 5 years, and people, you know, wanted to get a cell phone, and they were willing to pay a lot of money to get put to the top of that list, and I had the list. So did a little of that. I did a little, you know, after 50 beeps or 50 vibrates or 50 whatever, you know, you got charge 7 cents a minute. But, you know, if you had tickets to a concert or something like that, you might get all your calls zeroed out, because I knew the computer. But so that was, you know, some of the kind of thing. And I don't even really think I knew I was stealing from the company. You know, it was just, all I had to do was hit a button, you know. All I had to do was move the name to the top of the list. So I was already, you know, exhibiting that kind of behavior. And back then, let's see, disco was the big thing. And over here at Northeast Plaza, there was a bar called Packets. And I think we went to Packets every single night. We'd get off work, we'd go to Packets, we'd come home 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, get up, go to work, hungover as hell, and get off work, go to Packets. And that was my life, I mean, for, you know, well over 2 years. And by this time, I'm in my 20s. I may just be 20, 2021. I even had a timeline. I mean, I did so much work after Tim called me today, and I'm not even looking at this stuff. But anyway, it's my story. I should know this stuff. Anyway, I did my first geographical cure because I knew I was getting drunk every night. I knew I was sleeping around too much, and I just felt like I needed to settle down and try to do something different. And I really didn't know. I didn't know alcohol was a problem. I just knew I was wild, and something I needed to have something give. So I decided to go back up to Galax, because Galax is a little mountain town. There's nobody there. You know, nobody, you know, it's a Bible Belt. Nobody probably drinks or anything up there. And I wasn't there, you know, 2 weeks, and I found, you know, there are bars, there's moonshiners, there's bootleggers, there's everything, you know. Everywhere I go, there I am. So it didn't take me long to find the crowd that I had here, the same people. So, I stayed in Virginia probably, I found a job right away. I got a job in a bank, and they sent me down to Martinsville, Virginia to train as a teller, and I came back up and I worked as a teller. And there was this little disco called Grandfather's Place, and we would go there about every night it was open. And I got into another crowd that did a lot of horseback riding. And one of the men was an ex-husband of one of my aunts, and he always had a lot of horses, so he'd let me borrow his horse, and we'd go horseback riding about every weekend. And I just kept getting, you know, the same old thing, just hungover at work, feeling horrible. Here I am again, I'm in the same boat. And I had been in a relationship before I did the first geographical cure, and this is just how I was. This is how I based my decisions. It was real deep thought, contemplative decision making. The guy calls me. He says, "If you come back to Atlanta, we'll get married." So I quit my job and went back to Atlanta, and of course that didn't work out. And so I decided to go back up to Virginia. And when I went back up there, my whole plan was I was going to this bar, and if I ran into one of my old culls, then it was divine intervention, and I was supposed to marry him. Well, sure enough, I went to the bar, and I ran into Rachel's father. Or he wasn't her father yet, but we got there pretty quickly, and I went back to Virginia, packed up all my stuff, and my poor mother followed me up there. I told him, you know, I barely knew this man. I barely knew him, and on New Year's Day we drove up there. I had what I had, you know, a couple of suitcases, and I moved right straight in with him. And he was funny. We had a lot of good times, but you know, the relationship was very alcoholic, and it was a very tumultuous relationship. It was a lot of verbal and physical violence, and I was still maintaining. I got the job back at the bank when I moved back up there, and they gave me my job back. And like I said, I didn't call out sick, hungover, I mean, I got my ass up. I said, you get your ass up and you get to work. You did this to yourself. And, you know, I just kicked myself in the ass and I go on to work. Now, I wasn't worth a shit while I was there, but I showed up. And sorry for all the cussing, but that's just, you know, that's just part of what I do. And or how I talk, I guess. Like I said, my vocabulary is not that great. So anyway, worked at the bank, and I was with him a year. Now, never mind the fact that I had left him and went back to him and left him and went back to him, I don't know how many times. But, of course, getting married was going to make it better. So I married him. And then left and went back, left and went back, left and went back. And then, of course, having a baby would make it better. So had a baby. And by the time, you know, Rachel came along, it was just a little while before she was two. The having a child come into my life and trying to drink and trying to be wild, you know, and being as wild as I was, it didn't fit anymore. I mean, I had another person in my life that I wanted to. I didn't want her to watch us fist fight. I mean, sometimes we'd be in fights, she'd be on my hip, you know, and I couldn't stand it. It was just like I could not live that way. And so I ended up leaving and leaving for good right before she turned two. You know, of course, went back. My mother, God love her, she is such an enabler, and she just about loved me to death because she never did that tough love thing. But I'm grateful. I am very grateful to her that she always gave me a roof. So I went back to Georgia. I mean, back and forth all the time. You know, it was just, that's how I was. That it's going to be better here, a new life here, start over, that sort of thing. And so I went back to Georgia and moved in with Mama. And by this time, she had her own business. And she gave me a job. And so I was working for her, but I was still doing, you know, trying to be a mom, and I was still an alcoholic. I still was trying to live that life, although my life started becoming a little bit more of a double life because I was trying to be, you know, a responsible mom and go to work and give, you know, Rachel the things she needed, but I was also, you know, going out at night and leaving her with Mom. And so it wasn't very long after that. This was, you know, I left probably in 1987, and by 1988 I was married again. And you know, this marriage, if I thought the first marriage was crazy, this second marriage was absolutely over the edge crazy. It only lasted a year, but oh my God, I have just, if you think it can't get worse, it can always get worse. And it did. And I was, it didn't take me long to figure it out that I was not going to put, I didn't even think about myself, but I wasn't putting Rachel through any more of that. So I left. And I started trying to get my crap together, you know, and I ended up getting a promotion at work, and my mom was not my boss, and my promotions came, you know, from other areas. So I was doing well enough to at least advance. I don't know, you know, how, I'm sure I was advancing in my alcoholism on some level as well, but I was maintaining enough to advance in my job, and I was able to build my own home. And so it was like FHA and HUD or whatever, but a first-time homeowner, and I was able to pick an area that was considered a rural area, and I built a house in Auburn, Georgia. And, you know, Mom's company was, you know, was struggling financially, and new ownership came in, and it was very clear that they did not want the daughter of the main, you know, person there working. And so you could see little areas where they were trying to, you know, snuff me out. And so I ended up leaving the job. And somewhere in between there, I think it was 1992, Rachel was in gymnastics, and I would always go to, I would take her to gymnastics, and while she was doing gymnastics, I would step next door to the Ugly Mug Pub and have a few drinks. And one night, by this time I had a roommate. My second husband had two children, and I was, you know, and they were devastated when I left him. So I made best friends with my second husband's ex-wife, and I mean, we just became like best friends, and we ended up becoming roommates. So, and they were a lot older, and I called her my ex-wife, and but she had older children, and they would always, me and Debbie would go out partying, and we'd leave the three kids together because they were old enough to babysit. And anyway, it was just, you know, more of the same. And but this one particular night, Debbie was going to go home, so she took Rachel, and I stayed. And husband number three walks in the door, and it was the night that Sid Bream slid into home base, and we won the national pennant. They called it the Miracle Night. I mean, it was just, you know, just a great night. And champagne all around. And anyway, I met this guy and his friend, and anyway, he ended up asking me out, and I agreed, and it was kind of a normal relationship. It was a little bit scary. He asked me, I didn't go home with him. He asked me out for the next weekend, and which was really strange and different for me, but, you know, I accepted. And so the next weekend we went out, and I knew, I mean, it was just like this little voice, like, he's different. He's not, you know, he's not an alcoholic. He doesn't drink like you do. And I, for some reason, I felt like, well, you know, I can be that person, you know. So I really, probably from that point forward, really started living that double life. And by 1993, we were married. And that same year, my son came. So I don't like to say that it was a shotgun wedding, but it could have been a shotgun wedding because I was pregnant with my second child. And he would go out of town. I started drinking at home then, a lot then. By that time, it had escalated. And I did all the other things that they say in the book. I'd switched from vodka to tequila, from tequila to, you know, brown whiskey, from that to, by this time I was a wino, and or beer. And so he would leave for work or go out of town, and I would get up in the morning, and I would fix breakfast, and I would be, you know, Miss Susie Homemaker, and I'd get the kids off, I'd get Rachel off to school, and I'd get John's parents to stay out. Well, as soon as he walked out the door, or as soon as I got everybody out the door, I'd close all the blinds, wouldn't answer the phone, and I would, you know, start, you know, drinking beer. And I usually have to pick my son up by noon, 3 days a week. If he was at home, then I didn't have to worry about it until I had to pick Rachel up. So, you know, I would, you know, pound down some brewskis or wine or whatever, and then I would try to sober up before I had to get Rachel or before I had to get John. And you know, I'd come home, and right before he'd get home, then I'd open a bottle of wine. And so as far as he knew, I had just opened a bottle of wine. You know, unbeknownst to him, I'd been drinking all day. And I lived like that for a long time. You know, I lived like that for, you know, from 1993 until I came in. And that was 1997. I started having, and when I married him, I had been going to this church pretty regularly, and it's not a religious based church, and they don't you know, my church of my childhood was the hellfire and damnation, and you know, if you did wrong, all you had to do was ask Jesus to come back in your heart again, and everything would be white as, white as snow, and blah, blah, blah. But I just knew I was going to hell anyway, so I was going to have fun doing it. So, somewhere along the lines, I decided that wasn't my God. So I threw that religious God out for me. I don't care who y'all's God is, but this is my story. And I just knew that there was a different kind of God, a different, you know, a universal goodness, whatever. And this church, you know, helped me see another way. And so I saw Marianne Williamson, Deepak Chopra, you know, Carolyn Mace, a lot of the big names speak. I read a lot of their books. And, you know, a lot of people say throw those self-help books out. I don't even know that if I'd call them self-help. They're more like spiritual books. But I do know that that was the beginning of me kind of looking at, being able to look at myself and look at how I lived and looking at kind of the double life I was leading and that gnawing voice in the back of my head. And like sometimes I, you know, have two or three wines and I'd go flying. And people walk in my neighborhood all the time, and I just had this vision of I was just going to mow somebody down, you know, half drunk, backing out of my driveway, or get caught driving drunk with my kids, and my cousin's husband did get caught driving drunk with her kid, and defects. I mean, it wasn't defects; they were in North Carolina, but anyway, the child care people, whatever you want to call them, got involved, and I was like, you know, when is your time up, Debbie? When is this going to happen to you? And so one morning, I had no recollection of the night before, and evidently I was a pretty, I don't remember having violent spells, and I wasn't told I had violent spells. And my husband was always, this third husband was very kind. You know, the other husbands, they loved to point fingers, and I loved to point fingers back, and I was the victim of our violence and stuff like that. And I woke up, you know, I'd wake up out and not recall the night, but I'd get up and my kitchen would be clean, and, you know, and I could see that I had read books to the kids, so at least I had some kind of blackout responsibility. I don't know what that means, but... I'd wake up sick, 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 you know, and this one particular morning I got the kids off to school and I was just, oh my God, I just felt so horrible. And I thought, you know, how long are you going to live this way? You know, how long, when are you going to, what are you going to do? You know, and I was still trying to control it. I never swore off alcohol, not once. I was going to figure out how to get to that sweet spot and stay there. And I could never do it time and time and time again. I could not hold on to that little sweet spot. And so I went to a flyer that our church puts out, and I swear to y'all, I opened it up, and there was this heading. It said, "Do you drink periodically and find yourself drunk?" And I was like, "Yes, I do." "If so, this is the workshop for you." And the workshop was going to be the following Sunday, and we had already made plans to go to Florida. So my family and I went to Florida, and I told my husband, I said, "There's a workshop at Unity," and I said, "I want to get back in time to go to it." Because I knew in the back of my mind I was going to go to this workshop, and I was going to get told the secret of the sweet spot. Or I was going to find out I was an alcoholic. And so anyway, we got there on a Friday. We had his parents keep the kids that night. And my husband and I went out to dinner and had a few drinks. And there was something in the back of my mind that was like, you know, your number's up. So, I mean, I just absolutely... I just put one on, you know. I drank way too much because it was I knew it was my last drink, and I was just going to try to get all I could. And I woke up maybe 3 a.m. and I went to the bathroom, and it was a literal hell of a mess. And I had no idea that I was the one that made that mess. I even woke my husband. I said, "Honey, have you been sick?" It was me. And that was my last drink. That was the last drunk. Came home. I went to that. Try to watch the time. Oh hell, I ain't got sober yet, and it's 10 minutes till. So I went. I went to that workshop, and this guy, he was an attorney, and he had written a book, and he was, you know, he wanted to sell his book, of course, but he was an advocate of AA, and he did get sober through AA, and he, you know, he said, "You need to get a sponsor," and you know, blah, blah, blah. So I had been going to women's retreats. I joined the choir at church, and I'd been going to women's retreats, and this woman said she would always tell a little bit of her story during the women's retreat. You know, it was just, she was like giving the message. So I knew, I called her as soon as that workshop was over, and I said, her name was Ginger Kay, and she had at that time 7 years. And I said, "Ginger," I said, I know I'm an alcoholic, and I need a sponsor. And so she had me meet her on Monday. At the 5:45, I came here, and I picked up a white chip, and that just happened to be March the 17th, 1997. And so anyway, she got me in the steps right away, and she, told me that I should do 90 meetings in 90 days, and anything I put before AA, I would lose. She told me I had a lot of yes. And that was important to me, and that was, you know, I had never had a DUI. How, I don't know, because I had a lot of wrecks drinking. And I don't know how or why the cops didn't ask me if I'd been drinking, and but they didn't. And where the hell was I? What was I getting to on that one? But anyway, so she told me to do, yes. And I had not been in jail, hadn't been in treatment, hadn't been to a mental institution, and so those were all yes for me, and that kept me coming back. I didn't want those yes to get me, and it kept me coming back, and it kept me doing what was suggested. She took me through the steps, and you know, I usually go through the steps, so I don't think I'm going to have time. But when I walked in, these were, you know, some of the things I heard that were so important to me. And I don't know who has less than a year here tonight. Anybody less than 30 days? Okay. Well, these were some of the things I heard that were so important to me. And that was, it was the first drink that got me drunk. The very first drink that got me drunk. And that, you know, time takes time. And I wrote them all down. And let's see, that I wasn't a bad person. I was a sick person, and that was a mental obsession. And you know, all these things that I heard when I came in here that I just kind of latched onto. AA has its own language. And I walked in here and I didn't know what in the hell anybody was talking about. But I did have enough sense to keep my mouth shut and listen. I was scared enough because there was some old timers in here that would just put you in your place. And I did not want to be put in my place at all. And so I was afraid I might get mad and run out of here, and I wanted to be sober. So I did the 90 and 90. I did the steps. You know, I took suggestions. I came to the God of AA was the same God that I cultivated when I had left that religious God. You know, I felt like I had come home. And And I felt, and I always felt welcome here. I mean, the women, you know, came around me and with a lot in long-term sobriety and welcomed me. I joined the very next, that Monday night at the 5:45, I picked up my white chip, but the very next day it came to the 11 o'clock, and the 11 o'clock Bridge Builders group is my home group. It's been my home group for going on 20 years now. And, you know, I have done, I've done a lot of stuff in AA as far as service work, and I have a sponsor, and I've always had a sponsor. I never not had a sponsor, and I sponsored a lot of women, and some of the women that I started sponsoring as long as 12 years ago, I'm still their sponsor. I love these women. They're like my family. The people here in AA are like my family. I know some of these people. A lot of faces tonight I know, and I've known for years, and I don't even know your last name, but y'all are still like family to me. This is the only place I know you can come to that everybody in here wants to see you succeed. You know, they want to see you stay sober one day at a time, and I cannot tell you how important it is to for me to stay in a home group, to have a sponsor, to sponsor other women, to become a part of this program. This guy shared one time, he said he took it upon himself to do this survey or something, and I don't know how long, this, I heard this years ago, but every time he heard somebody say they went back out, he would go up to him after the meeting and he'd say, he had like three or four questions. And one of them was, did you work with another alcoholic that day? Or did you talk to another alcoholic that day and about, you know, staying sober? And 100% of the ones that said they went back out said no. They did not work with another alcoholic or have any contact as far as staying sober in the steps that day. And so, and that rang true. This meeting has been, this 8 o'clock meeting I've been coming to for years. And since I've been in the program, and it's been such a blessing in my life, because, you know, you can sit here. I have heard so many stories. I have had like belly laughs with some people's stories and some of their drunk logs. I have cried. The people get up here and they just absolutely pour their heart out. And they do that because they hope somebody in this room will hear what they have to say and maybe decide to, you know, give it one more day, or maybe even pick up a white chip. And, I mean, I can't even imagine what my life would be like if I hadn't come here. Or, you know, I'm still married to that same man that wasn't an alcoholic. He supported me wholeheartedly when I told him I was an alcoholic and I needed to get sober. And so I've been with him for 23 years. I have been, I got to start my own business 13 years ago. And, you know, I don't play well with others, so I never grew it. It's just me and the business. But still, it's my business, and I do it, and I get to make my own hours and that sort of thing. And I say I buy the groceries because that's about how much I bring in. But it's still, it's a way to contribute to the family. I've had service positions here at NABA, and NABA is not AA. If anybody gets that, confused me for a long time. They're separate entities, but NABA is one of the best clubhouses I have ever come in contact with in my entire life. I can tell you that this board here goes by those AA principles and traditions, and they care about these rooms and the people in these rooms, and they want to make this a safe place for people to come. So if y'all get pissed off about the building and grounds rules, then go talk to your sponsor about it. This is a beautiful program, and it is a way out of that incessant merry-go-round of doing the same things over and over and over again, expecting different results. So my prayer is that somebody in this room tonight heard something that will keep them coming back, and I thank you for having me up here.
Thank you, Debbie. I remember the first time I ever came. You were the only one that talked to me. And I was scared to death.